May it please the Court. Under Missouri law, when a person dies without a will and without a surviving spouse, that person's estate is distributed to the decedent's children or their descendants in equal parts. And if there are no children or their descendants, then to the decedent's father, mother, brothers, or sisters of their descendants, in equal parts. Probate court code goes on to state that if, for the purposes of intestate succession, a relationship of parent and child must be established to determine succession by, through, or from a person, an adopted person is the child of the adopting parent and not of the natural parent. In this case, Bella Vicavate is only entitled to inherit from her natural grandfather, Lonnie Brockmeyer, if she was a descendant of Lonnie's child on the date of his death. The appellant's position in this case is that Bella's mother, Sherry, was not Lonnie's child on the date of his death as a result of her decision to be adopted by her stepfather. By statute, that adoption took Sherry, the mother, as well as Bella, her daughter, out of the family tree of Lonnie and placed their family tree instead under the family tree of the adopting father. The probate court's error in this case lies in the portion of its September 24, 2012 judgment and order of partial distribution, which states that Bella Louis Gicavate is the natural grandchild of the decedent, Lonnie Lee Brockmeyer, and is therefore an heir. Nothing in the statute on intestate succession places a natural granddaughter by that role into a position of heirship. Only if a natural granddaughter is a descendant of a child of the decedent on the decedent's death is that natural grandchild an heir under the law. It's important to note that descendants of children of a decedent inherit through their parents, through the children of the decedent, and not independently through their own right. Now, the respondents in this case would urge the court to judicially revise Missouri's intestate succession statute to hold that all biological lineal descendants of a decedent can inherit. To reach that argument, the respondents ask the court to find that the intestate succession statute is ambiguous because it uses the term issue in subsection 1 and then switching gears down to children or their descendants in section 2.
So could this child inherit from, would you say the child could inherit from both grandparents?
I would argue that under the respondent's position, that's exactly what they propose, is that this grandchild could inherit both from her natural grandfather, Lonnie, and from her adopting grandfather, Mr.
Thank
Lewis. I contend that double inheritance is not what the legislature intended, and it is essentially double dipping and giving people an opportunity to inherit from both sides. And moreover, it gives both sides an opportunity to potentially inherit from that child as well.
Opposing counsel says the statute just explicitly talks about the child and goes into great detail if you look at the different statutes about the effects of adoption on the child, but never mentions descendants. And so we should interpret that silence on that issue as favorably to allowing this inheritance.
Your Honor, even if a natural grandchild stays in the family tree of a natural grandparent after the adoption, that still doesn't place that grandchild into the category of being an heir under our statutes of descent and distribution, because only descendants of a child can inherit. So even if nothing else changes about the family tree, I think that when you look at 474.010 and 474.060, read those two together, you find that in this case, Sherry cannot be a child of Lonnie, and therefore Bella cannot be a descendant of a child as a result of the statute that terminates the relationship between Sherry and Lonnie. It's worth noting that the section of the statute that respondents claim is ambiguous in using the term issue would never make a distribution in this case ever because there's no surviving spouse. Section 1 of 474.010 speaks of the distribution where there is a surviving spouse. In this case, there is no surviving spouse, and therefore we go down to the next level of distribution, which is there to children or their descendants, and if there are no children or their descendants, then on to the siblings and the parents in equal parts. So even if issue is to some extent ambiguous, which I don't believe it is, I think that we still reach the same result here. Furthermore, even if Bella could qualify, even if the term issue got us to some distribution here, issue is defined in the probate code to include adopted children and all lawful lineal descendants except those who are the lineal descendants of living lineal descendants of the intestate. Now, Bella may well be a biological lineal descendant of Lonnie. There's no doubt about that, and there's nothing that this court or any other court could ever do to terminate that natural biological relationship. But is she a lawful lineal descendant? And I think the answer to that is no. I think that the adoption terminated the lawful relationship. Biological relationship remains and will never go away. But is the relationship lawful? I don't believe under the statutes that it is. Now, the appellant asked this court to determine the intention of the legislature by looking at the plain language of the statute. This statute is plain, it's unambiguous, and I think that it should be given its effect. The respondents would ask the court to stretch the language to find an ambiguity so as to reach a more policy-based result, and I don't think that's appropriate given that the language in this case is clear. I do want to address some of the policy concerns and some of the practical concerns that the respondents have raised. There's no doubt in my mind, no doubt that an adoption proceeding has serious and real legal consequences, just like almost any other legal proceeding that goes in front of a court. But this is a proceeding that's reviewed by a judge, and the judge has the discretion to approve or withhold the adoption based on his or her review of the case. So I think that some of the potentially absurd results of adoptions being carried out in bad faith for the purpose of shaking up a family tree or whatnot, I think we should put our faith in our circuit judges that they're going to look at these situations and ensure that it's not done for improper purposes.
Your opponent argues that an existing minor child of a adoptee doesn't have notice, isn't represented, and so even if the judge is looking at the equities of whether or not to grant an adoption, the child of the adoptee is not at the table, isn't there to present the arguments as to why the adoption should not go forward. Can you address that?
Yes, I think that's a very important point to consider. It's true. In an adult adoption, the descendants would not typically be represented by a guardian ad litem, and that certainly didn't happen in this case. I think that the questions of due process, I think we need to go back to the state constitution and look at the categories of protected rights, life, liberty, or property. And in this situation, the right that the respondents urge this court to adopt is a right to remain in the lawful bloodline of a decedent. And so I don't see due process concerns there because it doesn't directly implicate a property right. The cases are clear that an heir has no interest in the property of a decedent until death. The living have no heirs, and no one is an heir to the living, according to the Wass versus Hammond Tree case.
If the biological grandfather here wanted to ensure that she took part of his estate, he could have made appropriate estate plans, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that's the very important point here, that the intestate succession statutes are merely a default. They merely step in when a person has failed to sign a will. Signing a will is probably one of the least expensive and most simple legal procedures that anybody can undertake. You write out your wishes in the presence of two witnesses, and you can dispose of your property. You can make nominations for guardians of your kids after your death. And that certainly could have happened here. If the biological grandfather, Lonnie, had wished to provide for Bella, he could have done so by a will. And that also raises the point that one can change, an heir can't, and expect an heir can't expect that things are going to remain that way. A grandparent could get remarried, could execute a will, could do any number of things to change their opportunity to inherit their property. And that's why the courts have long said that there's no right to a decedent's property until death. Now, I think that the respondents raised some valid concerns about how an adult adoption may affect generations down the family tree. I think that's a valid point. But I think that the the adoption and intestate succession statutes at this point are clear. If there are changes that need to be made, they should be made across the street by the legislature, because it is, in fact, a creature of statute. Both adoption, intestate succession, family relations, they're created by the legislature and are purely creatures of statute. The respondents also urge this court to invalidate the intestate succession statute on the grounds that it's a law with retrospective effect. I think that that argument is misplaced, because nothing about the law has changed since any of the operative events in this case have occurred. Since the date that Bella was born, there have been no changes to the statute. Nothing about that has changed. The fact that a statute gives the court the power to change the legal relations of parties does not make that law retrospective. When you're looking at a retrospective law, we have to look at, has the legislature enacted a law that treats antecedent transactions differently and has affected the rights of the parties by so doing? To conclude, the appellant in this case asks the court to reverse the probate court's order and judgment finding Bella Lewis Gicavate to be an heir, as well as its ruling just making a partial distribution of $25,000 to her. We'd ask that instead this court declare Ronald Brockmeyer the sole heir of his brother and direct the probate court to enter an appropriate judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Can you address the difference between Missouri and maybe the California statute? Would the California court decide to kind of go a different way and recognize the existing rights of the child?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whatever you want to call it.
I take it you've read the Estate of Davis case out of the California Court of Appeals, and I think that that statute treats issue differently. In that case, I think that the definition of issue would make a difference in this case, because I believe that the distribution was to issue. Now, let me say, I was not able to track down the statutory text at the time that this case was decided, so I don't know that I can speak very well as to exactly what the statute said. I would say that the statute was different, according to the case, from Missouri's current law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may it please the court. I have two children, and I'm very fortunate that my mother lives nearby and watches them several times a week when I and my wife are both at work. After this case was accepted for transfer, I was picking up my children. I was explaining the case and my argument to my mother. And really, it just didn't click for her what was going on until I flatly told her that under the appellate court's interpretation of the adoption statute, I, as an adult, could go out and voluntarily be adopted without telling her, without telling my children, without telling my wife, or telling anybody, and thereafter, my children would no longer be her grandchildren. And she did not care for that idea. That is the,
why is that for us as opposed to the legislature, though?
Because what we're looking at is simply the interpretation of the adoption statute on its plain face. And the adoption statute only states that the adoptee, the child in reference, is placed into the new family, the adopted family line, without reference to what happens to the adopted child's existing children. And there's no language in there that states that their children go with them. It just states that for all purposes, that one adopted person is treated.
So would be your position that there's no double recovery, but that the grandchildren could only inherit from the biological grandparents and could not inherit from the adoptive grandparents?
I think ultimately,
or parents.
I think ultimately the children of an adopted person, if they were in existence at the time of the adoption, would inherit from both grandparents, but for different reasons. They would inherit from their biological grandparents as the biological grandchild, and they would inherit from the adopted grandparent as the descendant of a child of the adopted grandparent. However, Missouri law has recognized and approved of double inheritances. In the Gardner v. Hancock case cited in my brief, there was a situation where a person inherited as an equitably adopted person and thereafter was still allowed to inherit from their biological family, even though they had been essentially abandoned, because their right to inherit from the biological family had not been judicially terminated. So there is, while I think a double inheritance could occur, it is not a legal problem. However, to address the point of both grandparents inheriting from the child, I do not think that would occur. Because if the grandchild were to die intestate, The intestate statute only talks about inheritance from their grandparents rather than the parents of their parent. So it only goes to their grandparent, who I believe would fall as the biological grandparent, rather than the parent of their parent. So
assuming we agreed with that, doesn't that hurt your position in this case, because the statute talking about distribution of the grandparents' estate doesn't talk about grandchildren?
No, but the statute
descendants of the children.
If you only look at the one part of the statute, it talks about children or their descendants. However, when you read the statute as a whole, it first analyzes whether there are surviving issue as part of the distribution to the surviving spouse. And surviving issue is defined differently than children or their descendants. And the difference in the definition is exactly what we have here. So to read the statute as a whole, you have to address the notion of surviving issue and what surviving issue include. I would suggest that surviving issue includes, by definition, lawful lineal descendants, which the grandchild in this case should remain and not be removed by.
Why is that word lawful there, as opposed to just saying lineal descendants?
The reason I would suggest it is there is because the unique determinations of children who are born out of wedlock, when you look at 474.060, it discusses.
So children born out of wedlock would not be able to recover, and that's what they were trying to exclude?
Well, there are, in 474.060, there's a definition that children born out of wedlock are the child of the mother and the child of the father if certain qualifications have occurred. Mm. And I would suggest that those qualifications are what the word lawful is set to address in that instance.
If we accept your definition, we have rules of construction that require us to give meaning to every word of the statute. And in the section, subparagraph 2, which actually covers this circumstance, it says it shall be distributed to the decedent's children or their descendants in equal parts. How does your interpretation give any meaning to those words?
The difference in the word.
You talk about the issue may be ambiguous, but you can't. You can't then define issue not to give effect to this language that doesn't appear to, it's not ambiguous unless you read it in context. But so how does your resolution of any ambiguity give effect to those words?
The effect that's given is just noting that it's a stylistic change, because to read the statute as a whole, it is to not give effect to the word surviving issue if you simply interpret surviving issue as children or their descendants. By definition, under 472.010, surviving issue is not the same as children or their descendants. So the effect that is given is noting that the legislature made a stylistic change, in my opinion.
But if there's any ambiguity, we have to read the provisions in context, in harmony with each other. And so we would have to try to define issue and still give effect to the decedent's children or their descendants in equal parts. So doesn't this language inform how we define issue rather than issue change this language?
I would suggest that issue is defined by 472.010, and the fact that the legislature first used surviving issue as the qualifier for what portion is taken from the surviving spouse, which otherwise would receive everything, places more importance on surviving issue. The legislature could just as well have said if there are surviving children or their descendants, but they chose the word surviving issue in that case. And then only when it came to distribution, where there was the need to differentiate which generation of surviving issue takes, did the legislature then say children or their descendants. I would say it makes more sense that it is clarified for the distribution levels and the generational priority that they use children or their descendants when distributing the part, rather than simply ignoring the fact that they use surviving issue as the limiting factor for what is taken away from the surviving spouse.
Going back to your example that you gave when you started your argument and reflecting upon Judge Fisher's question, couldn't your mother provide for your children, her grandchildren, through a will, through a trust, through other means to make sure that they inherit her estate?
A person certainly has the right to create their own will. However, the flaw in that thinking is that she might never know that I was adopted. So her will could provide to her children or her grandchildren, but if I was adopted, then I would no longer be her child. And without any intent, I would be removed from her will. And likewise, if she provided will to her grandchildren and I was adopted, she would never necessarily know unless I told her, and that provision to her grandchildren would no longer include my children. And many wills that are written that way, where it just provides to their children in the event that in the future they were to adopt further children or otherwise increase their family size. And this, the interpretation allowing a person to unilaterally remove their existing descendants from their ancestral line would still have an effect and disruption on planned estates and wills that are written that way without specifically naming a child.
The Court of Appeals has held many times that grandparents have no visitation or other rights with respect to the minor children of adopted children. Would we have to overrule those cases to side with you in this case?
With respect to minor children of adopted children, I don't believe they would need to be overruled because a grandparent, and in fact it supports my position because it would leave the right to visitation with the biological grandparent.
No, that's exactly what they held that it doesn't do. That the biological grandparent, once the child is adopted by another, has no rights with respect to that child's minor children, to the minor grandchildren.
I can't say that I've reviewed every case, although I imagine that it might be distinguishable on the idea that those grandchildren were not in existence at the time of the adoption of the child.
They're actually adoption cases, and the issue was notice and all the things that you complained that theoretically would not be given to you. They were not given. And the rationale was that when the adopted child moves out of that bloodline, the entire bloodline moves, that child and all of that child's descendants. So it sounds like you would disagree with those cases, at least in principle.
Again, my apologies, I'm not familiar with them, although I think that if it moves existing children at the time the person is adopted, then I would disagree with it in principle, yes.
Is there anything in the statute that utilizes the words existing or that concept to make a distinction between existing children and children to be born in the future?
The statute, there is no language, although the statute does not address whatsoever what happens to children of the adopted person. It just states the adopted person is treated as being part of the new family bloodline. However, to interpret it as meaning that their existing children go into the new family bloodline with them, as the statute created a legal effect on non-represented parties by the adoption of an adult voluntarily.
Wouldn't
the pre-termitted heir statute cover that scenario?
I do not. I do not believe so. Although
there was an adult adoption, and the pre-termitted heir statute allowed for unknown heirs at the time of a will, even for example, to be able to inherit. I mean, if you're worried about the unknown, wouldn't you?
I've not reviewed recently the pre-terminated heir statute, although I don't think it would be applicable in the sense of discussing grandchildren who are removed by their parents' adoption. I simply don't think it would.
It's more the flip side, I guess.
I would say so, yes.
If Sherry had not been adopted, in this case, would Bella have any right at all to the decedent's estate or any part of it?
No, Sherry would be first in line for it as a child, although if she had predeceased, then Bella would have rights.
So your contention is that by being adopted, we should treat her as being dead for purposes of this statute. We have to treat her as being dead.
For purposes of the statute, I would suggest that Bella is entitled to inherit as a lineal descendant and that yes, the more proper treatment would be that Sherry is simply treated as either dead or non-existent rather than...
Well, non-existent, then she can't take. She's a descendant of a non-existent. That's not covered. So I see no way to do it other than if she's dead.
It goes back to my suggestion that the intestacy statute as a whole is inconsistent by using surviving issue in the first part to set apart a an inheritance portion for surviving issue, and thereafter distributing it as children or their descendants, which has a different legal definition than surviving issue.
You rely heavily on Davis, and I asked your opposing counsel about it. What's the difference, and how is Davis applicable to Missouri?
I would say Davis is applicable based upon the consistent notions that it does not necessarily translate that an adult getting adopted should move their children with them in the adoption. There's no reason that you need to treat the children as a member of the new family unless that's the specific intent, and if that's the specific intent of the adult being adopted, they can thereafter adopt their own children to bring them into that new family. But otherwise, one should not disrupt an existing child's entire family line without them having any say-so or a desire to do so.
Well, did Davis do it based on like this vested right, or was this in statutory language in California that's different in Missouri's or similar to Missouri's?
From what I recall, the Davis case, it addressed the notion of issue. It did not have the particular contested statute quirk that Missouri has of the separate sections of surviving issue and thereafter children or their descendants. But the Davis case was looking at surviving issue and whether or not existing children should remain as surviving issue of a descendant after their parent has been adopted, whether their parent takes them to the new bloodline with them after the adoption.
So under Davis, they would not inherit from the adoptive parents? They would only be part of the original line?
I do not recall the specific language as whether or not it would allow them to inherit as surviving children of the adopted parent, although I believe California does have an anti-lapse statute similar to Missouri, such that if there was a gift given to the parent, it could lapse over to them, could survive over to them.
I understand.
And that's something that, again, there's discussion of the language in 474.060 about inheriting through an adopted person. And I'm not aware of a case that has interpreted the language through, but I believe that it could be suggested that inheriting through a person is is similar to a lapsed gift where you inherit through them rather than having direct standing as a lineal descendant, as a grandchild. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, then respondents would respectively request this court order that Bella Jacobot is an heir of the decedent and affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you, counsel.
Respondent's counsel addresses the issue of a double inheritance and points out that there is at least one case in Missouri that permits such a double inheritance. And I think it's worth distinguishing that matter because an equitable adoption is quite different from a statutory adoption. In the statutory adoption, it's clear that there is termination of rights between the natural parent and the adoptive child, whereas an equitable adoption is instead intended to remedy a promise to adopt or a contract to adopt that was never fully carried out. I think that that is an important distinguishing factor. I don't believe the legislature intended for one child to be able to inherit from both sides. But in closing this up and looking at the big picture, I think we can narrow this all down to one analysis. On the date of Lonnie Brockmeyer's death, was Sherry his child? If Sherry was not his child as a result of the adoption, Bella cannot be a descendant of a child. Bella cannot be an heir if, in fact, on the date of Lonnie's death, Sherry was not a child. And that's the question that I would urge this court to focus on in making its decision.
You know, the interesting thing about that case, though, the equitable adoption, the person had already received from the adopted, so-called adopted family.
Correct.
And therefore received under our statutes subsequent to that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So the double recovery was, by that court, distributed based on the legislative scenario that we have under our statutes.
I think that the situation is different. I think that the equitable adoption is a court-created doctrine that was applied to complete an adoption that wasn't legally completed. under statutory adoption, I just believe the process is different. So I don't know that situation is exactly analogous to what we have in the case of Barr.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The matter will be taken under advisement.